You're listening to Energy Insiders, a weekly update on clean energy and climate policy with Renew Economies editor Giles Parkinson and leading energy analyst David Leach. Energy Insiders is brought to you by Evergen, providing cutting-edge energy management software for battery optimization, virtual power plants and distributed energy resources. And Pylon, helping solar installers and retailers design high-resolution solar proposals in minutes.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of the Energy Insiders podcast. My name is Giles Parkinson. I'm the editor of Renew Economy and its associated websites, the EV Focused, the Driven and One Step Off the Grid. Joining me as usual is ITK Principal David Leach. David, I trust you are well.
I am well, thanks Giles. I trust all our listeners are well, and I want to offer an early apologies for some minor technical hiccups with last week's edition, which were quickly overcome. And haven't we got a great guest this week?
Yeah, we do have a very good guest this week, Victoria Energy Minister Lily D'Ambrosio. Big week for Victoria with the announcement of the revelation of the chosen dozen to explore the possibility of offshore wind farms, and we'll get to that very, very soon. Just on the technical difficulties we had with the interview with Federal Energy Minister Chris Bowen, if you listen to it in the very soon after it was published, have another listen to it because there's actually some gaps in it. We're not too sure what quite happened there. I'm going to blame David's mobile phone, but in the end, within 24 hours, we had it all fixed and the whole thing was uploaded properly. It sounded quite coherent, but funnily enough, there was actually big gaps, but we thank for it. It's a really interesting interview, so if you did listen to it very early on in the piece, have another listen because there's even more. Look, David, in the meantime, we've got a few things to talk about this week, not a huge amount of news, but look, let's get into the interview that we've got with Lily D'Ambrosio, the Victoria Energy Minister, and I had a chat with her earlier today. Lily D'Ambrosio, welcome back to the Energy Insiders podcast.
Always pleased to be with you, Giles. Thank you.
Yeah, big week for Victoria Energy News. Appointment of Simon Corbell as chair of the State Electricity Commission, but also the announcement of the revelation of the winning tenders for the feasibility studies for the first offshore wind farms in Victoria. Now, you've announced six winners and then another six sort of in first reserve, as it's, if you like. I understand that they've still got to work through negotiations with First Nations groups, etc. But you're going to end up with 12 different projects doing feasibility studies.
Well, this is a fantastic outcome, and we were always very confident that the work that we've been doing in Victoria to provide confidence to what effectively are global investors continue to see Victoria as a great place to produce the first offshore wind energy projects in the country. And we've worked very closely with the Commonwealth. These feasibility licenses that have been issued to the first six winners, if you like, and the other six that are still needing to go through some processes, means really speaks volumes, and I think is testament to the real confidence that these global investors and offshore wind energy producers and will actually have in Victoria. And certainly it really augurs well for our auction process that will kick off next year.
Yeah. The of the 12 winners, I think almost all of them, all the projects are dominated by international investors. I guess that's to be expected because they've probably got deeper pockets. They've also got experience with offshore wind. There's a couple of big Australian companies, Origin Energy and AGL, with kind of what you describe as minor roles in a couple of the projects. Is that a problem?
No, not a problem at all. I think what you've got here is a really great depth of understanding by all of these project proponents that they need to have consortiums to be able to put their best foot forward in what will be a very competitive auction process. So that's really critical here. And I think when you've got some of the Australian players having got themselves involved through a consortium process, that really tells you how serious all of these proponents are to actually be ready and to participate in our auction. So obviously there's a lot of work that each of them has to do now. A feasibility license is one important gateway. A lot of data collection, research, that needs to be developed in that next phase. But we're very confident now, of course, that with this first gateway and the potential for the other six proponents to also receive a feasibility license in coming weeks or months, it really does give you a very good sign of the confidence that investors have in what is a very competitive global market, that Victoria will be a great place for them to invest and develop projects.
So do you expect all 12 projects to be in a position to be able to bid into that first auction? And do we have any idea about the size of that first auction? I mean, how many projects will it be seeking to contract? And do we expect over time that all 12 projects might be operating in Australia or in Gippsland? Because they're each going to be spending quite a bit of money on those feasibility studies. I mean, they're not cheap.
They're not cheap, that's for sure. And that's why we've been very, very careful and in very deep ongoing consultation with industry over quite a period of time now to understand, but also to understand globally, how have these projects actually developed? What were the conditions that were needed, either regulatory conditions, auction conditions, if you like, and local content conditions, a whole range of conditions that informed each of our three implementation statements. And they are effectively statements to the market so that they could understand and be confident that a Victorian government actually understood about what those conditions were that needed to be satisfied to give confidence to what effectively are multi-billion dollar investments to be able to come along for the journey and ultimately participate in an auction process. So we're very confident. Now, whether all of these six or the 12 end up bidding into an auction process, that's a matter for them to determine, of course. But we're very pleased that this gateway process through the issuing of feasibility licenses have produced a very good outcome, a very healthy number of proponents coming through to the next stage.
Your initial targets, I think, are 2 gigawatts by 2032, and I can't remember, is it 4 or 5 gigawatts by 2035? You've talked in the past of possibly the first production occurring before the end of this decade. Are you still hopeful of that timeline, what's the latest thinking there?
Yeah, well, what we've done, and just recently we've legislated for the offshore wind energy targets, you're quite correct, at least 2 gigawatts by 2032 and 4 gigawatts by 2035 and then 9 by 2040. And we've also updated our broader renewable energy targets for 2030 and beyond and climate emissions targets. So what our focus is on having at least 2 gigawatts of projects built and generating by 2032. Now, if any of these projects can be able to achieve generation before then, that'd be terrific. But our aim is to make sure that we've got the capacity of at least 2 gigawatts ready and generating by 2032.
And maybe now's a good time to remind the listeners why exactly we do want offshore wind. The costs tend to be higher than onshore wind. What exactly is the attraction of having offshore wind farms in Victoria?
Well, it's not a nice to have. What we're very keen in Victoria, our government, we realise that we've got a lot of big projects that need to be built, whether they are onshore or offshore. And the reason why offshore is really important and is an important component of achieving our 95% renewable electricity target by 2035 is the diversity of renewable energy resources and ensuring that we've got a deep and broad diversity of generation coming into Victoria and into the grid. The reason for that, of course, is that when you have a think about a state like Victoria, we've got fantastic parts of Victoria that have got fantastic solar resource. Then you've got wind resource onshore that gives you potentially electricity at different times of the day to when solar can give you the energy. Offshore wind is a totally different potential. It gives us a much higher capacity of electricity generation over a much longer period of time. And that means that if we're low in a solar resource or a wind resource onshore, we can have that important availability of offshore wind resource, which is almost, and I think I'd probably be safe to say that it's a constant source of generation capacity coming into our grid. And then, of course, we couple that with storage technologies onshore, which will give us that really deep, diverse reliability of electricity that we need, that is available to us when we need it, regardless of the time of the day or night that we need it.
Okay. One of the potential problem or blockages with the offshore wind plan has been where it's all going to arrive in the port. And there was a proposal to turn the Port of Hastings into like an offshore wind turbine hub. One of the proposals has been pushed back by the federal government under environmental issues. You have said before that you are confident of getting a workaround on that. What's the latest on the Port of Hastings and your plans there?
Well, look, we continue to work with the Commonwealth to step through the issues that they have in terms of conditions for approval, and that remains a priority for us. And the Commonwealth have indicated that they are very keen to continue to work with us, and that's what we're doing. I think it's important also for us to realise that there will be more than one port that will be needed for us to be able to deliver our offshore wind energy projects, certainly in the first term, the first tranche of them. So we're moving ahead, and we are absolutely on track to be able to deliver those first projects. So continue to work with the Commonwealth. Hastings Port remains the most logical port to be a major contributor to the assembly of our first offshore wind energy projects. And as I said, we'll keep working with them and look forward to us being able to move into an expression of interest process later this year, and then moving into a formal tender process next year.
The Capacity Investment Scheme has been announced, the first big round of the large-scale renewables. Well there's actually there's a couple of different auctions happening. The first round with Victoria, South Australia, looking for dispatchable capacity, essentially sort of four-hour battery storage as an average. I mean, that seems to have been had an overwhelming response. Well, I think looking for 600 megawatts and 2,400 megawatt hours, and you ended up with sort of 19,000 megawatts and I think about 70,000 megawatt hours of proposals. So that's just shows that there's a huge pipeline of projects wanting to be built. I guess they're just also looking for contracts and certainty and investment certainty. I guess just we'll start off with that. I mean, that must be sort of reasonably gratifying that there's so many projects out there.
Oh, look, definitely. And I think it's probably fair to say that the last 18 months, there's been a pipeline of projects and the industry seeking certainty. And it's good that the Commonwealth has made available that first auction that is about helping to meet the reliability gap. And storage is a critical part of that across South Australia and Victoria. So we're very pleased to see that. What's really important now, of course, is to ensure that the rest of the capacity investment scheme is rolled out, providing the certainty, the longer term certainty that the industry needs to get a financial investment decision on a whole range of projects that are waiting for that policy certainty, if you like, to be able to come forward. So we continue to negotiate with the Commonwealth around the capacity investment scheme and what we would hope that it delivers for Victoria. We've certainly, the Commonwealth did talk about the need for additionality. Certainly what we're very keen to ensure is that the capacity investment scheme does not disadvantage Victoria by way of the fact that we've got very, very ambitious targets for 2030 and beyond. We want to make sure that the capacity investment scheme does not, in the way that it's rolled out and made available, does not disadvantage Victoria in terms of the degree of ambition that we have. So that's why we're continuing to have conversations with them about what it could look like for Victoria. We want to make sure that, you know, all of the heavy lifting that Victoria's done now for a number of years, where in fact we've had no real genuine partnership with the previous Commonwealth government, we did it on our own. But we want to make sure that we're not, as I said, that means that we've set strong, ambitious targets. We've met all of those targets in terms of renewables for 2020, 2025. We're well on the way to meeting that target. But we need to make sure that that the Commonwealth, provides provides its contribution so that Victoria gets its fair share for the 2030 target.
Yeah, we sort of because the first big auction is the 6 gigawatts. I think it's the biggest ever renewable auction to be had in Australia. But 2.2 gigawatts is reserved for New South Wales, 300 megawatts for South Australia. There's no particular allocation to Victoria. Is that because you have not yet reached that agreement with the federal government? That's right.
Look, I'm confident that we will, but we want to make sure that we get our fair share. That's the reality of it. I mean, because the important thing here, again, is that we've got very ambitious target of 65%, and we've put a lot. I mean, we've had, you know, a significant build on renewable energy in Victoria because of the state government's commitment to drive confidence in this state. And because of that, we've got lower wholesale prices. In a situation where, compared to the rest of the national energy market, we've got the lowest wholesale prices we've have had consistently now for a long while. We want to make sure that we don't end up through a national auction process that the Commonwealth will undertake that we simply don't have, because proponents will be seeking the bigger the better prices, if you like, the higher prices in other states. That shouldn't come at the expense of Victoria, because the reason why we're in the position of having consistently the lower wholesale prices is because of the big heavy lifting that we've done. So Victorians should be rewarded rather than disadvantaged. But look, we're working our way through it. I'm confident that we'll get there. We've still got a little bit to go, though.
Will there be any link between the CIS and the auctions that you're planning to run for the offshore wind farms? Will it be like a similar process? Will the offshore wind farms be part of the capacity investment scheme, or will it be two separate processes?
Well, certainly that's a subject of discussion broadly that I'm having with Minister Bowen, and our two departments are having. Let me put it to you this way, Giles, is that I've spent a lot of time engaging with countries that have actually gone first and built offshore wind energy projects. In all of the countries that have built up an offshore wind energy sector, national governments have played an important role in the financing of those projects. Right now, as it stands, the Commonwealth's contribution, although very much appreciated and welcome, and I applaud them for the work they've done thus far, has still there's still no commitments made by the Commonwealth to assist or work with the state government in Victoria, and we'll be the first movers. We'll be getting the first projects offshore built in the country. There's still no commitment from the Commonwealth to work with the state and collaboratively for the financing part of getting these projects actually built. And that's critical. for us. No other country globally that has built offshore wind energy has relied solely on a subnational government to get these projects built. So the Commonwealth government have got national plans for green hydrogen development. They've got national plans for electric vehicle, and they need a plan that includes financing and funding for offshore wind energy. So we'll continue to have our conversations. It's got to be more, though, than just giving regulatory approvals, although, of course, they are critical for us to be able to move to the next step.
That sounds like it's going to be a very interesting discussion, and it sounds like, that should be interesting. Look, I know that we're sort of short of time. We just do thank you for your time today. Just a quick couple of other things. There's still a very big pushback by the Federal Coalition Against Renewable Projects. It seems of all sizes and all sorts. I think Dan Tehan, the Federal MP, was quoted as saying this week that he would undeclare the new renewable energy zone off the offshore wind zone off the coast of Portland around the electorate that he represents. How unhelpful is the coalition's pushback against renewables in terms of sort of, you know, attracting investment?
Well, it is very disappointing to hear that from Dan Tehan. At some point in time, he's certainly had a more positive view on the importance of transitioning to a new energy supply, a electricity supply through renewables. He seems now to be going backwards at a very fast rate in terms of the contribution, the really vital and important contribution that offshore wind energy needs to play in Victoria's energy transition. As I said earlier, Giles, this is not a nice to have. We need this. We also need to have a look at the fact that Victoria's land mass is not, you know, whilst Victoria is big in global terms, in terms of land mass, when it comes to the amount of new energy supply that we need to build, we really need to ensure that that we continue to build onshore, and we're going to continue to need more built onshore, whether it's solar or wind or pumped hydro, whatever technologies that can be developed. Offshore will play an important role for the reasons that I mentioned earlier. Now, it is very disappointing that the Commonwealth opposition, and I must say that the state opposition is going the wrong way on this too, are yet again wanting to push an ideology ahead of practicality when it comes to energy transition. And what they're also doing is saying no to 59,000 jobs that we'll be creating in Victoria by 2035 alone for Victorians. And guess what? The ones who are going to benefit greatly Victorians Victorians who live across the regions, regional Victorians. So I think, you know, they've got an explanation to make. I mean, what they want to do, though, is, of course, have sidetrack conversations around technologies like nuclear that are simply going to lock Australians and Victorians into exceptionally high energy bills for decades. Plus, this technology is not readily available. You can't go to a shop and pick it up off the shelf. So it's all designed to slow down confidence in investing in renewables and slow down the build of renewables. That's not good for anyone, because right now, Giles, we know this. The coal generators in Victoria are getting old. They're getting older with every year that goes by. They're getting less reliable with every year that goes by. And they have a finite life. And they're reaching the end of life. And if you think that that's not going to be a problem, and doing nothing is your answer, or having nuclear, which is effectively doing nothing for years to come, and then, of course, lumping people with, you know, crazy high energy bills for decades, then, you know, you're actually putting ideology and a political fight ahead of practicality and going with technologies that are the cheapest form to build, the quickest form to build, that will support fantastic jobs and skills development in our country, and supply chain, offshore wind energy supply chains are going to be fantastic for Victoria. You think about all the people that have got fantastic skills that have been built around our traditional energy source, our engineering, our capacity around manufacturing. Offshore wind will deliver fantastic jobs where we can have those skills that we already have in Victoria, and that's our fantastic advantage. We've got a natural advantage there. Transferring those to new industry, to new energy industry, that's only a plus for Victorians. And we're not about getting having ideology get in the way of practically what we need to do. And we've got to have the smooth transition. That means working with communities, planning for it. I know that there's lots of councils in the regions at Gippsland, but also to the west of our state, that are really seeing offshore wind as a fantastic boon for their communities. And they're excited. They can see the economic development opportunities for them, and they're excited to work with us. I have lots of representations from them every other week, our commitment to them is to deliver on this, because their communities are going to be the beneficiaries in the end. And Commonwealth politicians or state opposition politicians who get in the way of this are not acting in the interests of local communities or regional communities.
Just one final question then. Simon Corbell has been appointed the chair of the SEC. He's the former ACT Energy Minister, of course, and you would have dealt with him oftentimes in that role. And he's also been the renewable energy advocate for Victoria in the past. What will be his primary function now that he's going to be chair of the SEC? And what's the SEC's next priorities? They've already signed up to their first battery storage project. What's next on the agenda?
I'm really excited that Simon Corbell has made himself available to chair the SEC board. And when you have a look at the calibre of appointees that I announced a few days ago, you can see that we've got a wealth of experience there. We've got investor experience. We've got people who understand the energy system. We've got people who understand the importance of consumers. I know they're going to waste no time in just getting on with it. Now, we know Simon Corbell comes with a wealth of experience. He's a great talent. And what they're going to be doing, of course, is be very much guided and focused on the strategic plan that the Premier and myself released late last year. That's a strategic plan that takes us to 2035. And of course, we've already got that first big investment that the SEC committed to, signed up to late last year. I've been very clear to the SEC, the board, Simon Corbell, absolutely know that we're going to get on. They're going to get on with building that 4.5 gigawatt capacity of new renewable energy projects by 2035. So we're very impressed. I'm very impressed. We've got, of course, the Melbourne Energy Hub, a fantastic project that was announced late last year. That's going to be providing more than 1 gigawatt of storage. Importantly, where it's situated it will unlock grid constraints across 3 renewable energy zones. So it's a really well strategically placed project. I'm really keen to look at the SEC and the next project that they'll be considering. I know work is underway on that front too. I can't say more than that, but I know Simon is ready to go on that. And also, of course, the commitment that we've made to run a community-facing pilot projects in the second half of this year, and that'll be a high priority also. And that's about helping households electrify, getting the benefits of electrification, the bill savings that come with that, but having a trusted entity, which is the SEC. The other important feature, the other important focus that Simon Corbell and his new team will have is to provide and work on and deliver the pilots for consumer-facing energy projects. Electrification will be a big agenda running through those pilots. We want to make sure that the SEC can be a trusted voice and support for consumers, for households to navigate their way through electrification. Electrification is going to make is really going to deliver fantastic bill savings for Victorians and build up, of course, the profile for the SEC to be a trusted entity. We know that public ownership of some of our assets, a trusted public voice and consumer advocate, is something that is missing in Victoria. It's been missing since the privatisation happened, and we'll have more to say on that in the coming months. So I'm very excited by this, and I know that Simon and his team are raring to go.
It's going to be interesting, and particularly sort of Victoria's move towards electrification, because it is the state currently with the, I guess, the households most dependent on gas, and it's probably room for another conversation there. But look, Minister Lily D'Ambrosio, look, we do appreciate you joining us for the Energy Podcast, and thanks for your time, and good luck with your talks with the Feds.
Thank you so much, Charles.
And that was Lily D'Ambrosio, the Victoria Energy Minister. David, what do you make of all this offshore wind? I mean, one of the issues we've seen with offshore wind overseas is that it's the costs have gone up dramatically in the last couple of years. They're probably starting to come back down now. And I think most people would be hoping that they continue to fall, because it's possibly hard to see how they can be competitive with other technologies in Australia. And it's interesting, I thought Lily D'Ambrosio's revelations about these discussions with the federal government and trying to make sure that Victoria gets its share of the auctions in the capacity investment scheme. And I guess that's one of the things about the auctions. We've seen capacity reserve for New South Wales, and obviously they've got a great need for more bulk energy because they've got sort of coal-fired power stations, which should be closing soon, and South Australia, Victoria, not yet. Is it a problem that they've got the lowest wholesale prices in the grid at the moment?
Well, no, that's not a problem, except it depends. It's a problem if you're a producer, and it's less of a problem if you're a consumer or a politician. It's nice to have low prices and to be able to talk about that. And we know that the prices are low, largely because there is plenty of capacity in Victoria, plus there are imports from Tasmania and South Australia, but there's not much ability to export to New South Wales at the moment due to transmission restrictions, which won't be overcome for a little while. The fundamental problem for Victoria, which has been identified time and time again on this podcast and in the ISP, I mean, you can approach the problem from two ways. The first is that Victoria is not the world's best place to have renewable energy. It's not even Australia's best place, really, at least onshore, I don't think. But historically, Victoria's been an overproducer, and it's been an overproducer in supply to other states because brown coal had, with it before considering the incredible carbon cost, before that, it had a very low fuel cost. So it made a great baseload supply historically, and offshore wind is just going to have a much higher cost, I think, maybe not a higher, but probably even a higher variable cost, but it's going to be expensive to replace the brown coal with offshore wind. And I don't personally think that, looking at it from the point of national point of view as opposed to Victoria's point of view, that a lot of offshore wind is the right answer. But Victoria does see it that way.
Yes, it's going to be interesting. I mean, they hope to have the first generation up in the early 2030s. I think the pricing and the support that that the Commonwealth gives them in terms of the CIS, and in fact, I find it hard to imagine how they can probably afford it without the Commonwealth support and a mechanism like the CIS, but it'll have to be a reserved part of the CIS. It'll have to be like a different pile, if you like.
Well, Victoria's immediate problem is that your lawn is going to close in 2028. The recently released report from the Grattan Institute said that there needs to be more transparency around these coal deals, and certainly there is no transparency that I'm aware of in any coal station support deal. No one knows anything about it except the internal parties. And as we've remarked before, this means all the other parties that operate generators are operating at a disadvantage because their competitors are getting capacity payments or reserve payments or support payments, and no one in the market actually knows what they are. But nevertheless, your lawn is going to close in 2028, and we have the Golden Plains wind farm, but that won't replace it on its own. It's also, I think, only honest to say that the capacity investment schemes that Victoria has run achieved great prices, but some of that capacity has yet to actually come online or even start being built. And this is one of the major worries with the capacity investment scheme overall, to ensure that there are enough conditions in it once you get a contract, it isn't just a free option to the person, to the generator that wins it, the developer, that they actually are so incentivized to build it, not just because they're going to get the capacity payment or the floor price, but because they're going to have to pay like crazy. I was going to use a different word. Have a big penalty if they don't actually build it. So there are still a few wrinkles to be worked out or to see how they actually go around the entire thing. But the point is, Victoria does need capacity to replace your lawn and then to replace Loy Yang. They have identified offshore wind, but I'm not sure that it wouldn't be better for Victoria to be more of an importer and to still have more onshore wind and stuff and more solar. That's what the studies, modelling studies, often seem to indicate.
Interesting. Hey, look, just on Eraring, and you talked about sort of coal-fired generators and the payments from state governments. There's been a bit of speculation about Eraring this week. Two questions I've got for you. One, do you actually expect that we will actually be told how much Origin receives if Eraring is to be extended? And would it surprise you to learn that Eraring will not be extended? I mean, I think there's an expectation that at least two units might be extended for a couple of years, you know, to get them over the next couple of summers, get past the next state election, blah, 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 blah. The latest speculation, and it is just speculation, is that it will be all four units for possibly 4 years or even 5 years.
So I think the electricity statement of opportunities that AEMO produces and is widely cited in the market, it's always cited when there's a shortage. If there's going to be a surplus, no one talks about it, because all the broader news market cares is about problems. They never care about successes or even write about them hardly. But nevertheless, if the ESO, in my opinion, there isn't enough replacement capacity, enough energy. There's plenty of power, plenty of batteries, and there's gas power, but there's not enough underlying energy likely to be built by the scheduled retirement date of Eraring. That's point one. And point two, which we identified on this podcast ages ago now, is that Origin itself has done nothing to replace Eraring. So it can't afford to have it close. The fact is, in my opinion, if the government didn't negotiate with Origin would probably keep Eraring going, but it would worry about the money it would lose. The third thing to think about is the fixed coal prices that all the coal generators in New South Wales can access. I think we've identified that there's about $100 million of profit tied up in those coal prices. So they're due to end on June the 30th. So I guess all this is a way of talking around the issues, but will we see all the details? I wouldn't bet a lot of money on it.
Let's move back on to the healthiest part of the Australian energy transition. And you just mentioned battery storage. There's going to be plenty of battery storage in New South Wales. There's going to be plenty of battery storage elsewhere. We're seeing a few interesting things. One, of note was Acacia Energy's financing for two new batteries, Brendale and Yulinda Park in New South Wales. And that was interesting because they said it was like the first of its type for battery storage. And I guess that's of note because it is institutions coming in and looking at a battery and go, okay, we're happy enough with this technology and its market position and we will finance that. The second one, I guess, is the new contract by Neoen, one by Neoen for the Collie battery. There's two huge batteries being built in Collie, both over 2,000 megawatt hours, one by Synergy, the Neoen one, which is now expanded with Stage 2. They've won another contract with the WA government, two-year contract, quite specific, basically flatten that solar duck, sort of soak up the rooftop solar in the middle of the day and sort of put it back into the grid in the evening. Fascinating stuff, and also interesting because we're seeing this happen in real life in California, which is one of the world's biggest grids. And we're seeing now over the last spring, and I guess that's, you know, that seems to be the season of records, no matter where you are in the world for the grids, because temperatures aren't too hot, but the sun is good and the other conditions are good. And we're seeing batteries becoming the biggest supplier into the grid in California, up to 25, 26, 27% of capacity. And for lengthy periods in the evening, between about two and a half hours over the evening peak. And I guess that's a postcard from the future for the Australian grid.
I agree, Giles. And it's a role that everyone has anticipated that batteries would start to fill. The thing about batteries is that they need a certain price that they're going to achieve every day, or a capacity payment. But if we just look at it as a merchant sort of thing, they need to get a spread between what they buy at and what they sell at every day. That's a certain level. In Australia right now, it's probably closer to $300 a megawatt hour than $200 a megawatt hour, but the cost will come down. But once the battery is built and installed, then it only needs like $5 a megawatt hour difference to cover its actual operating costs. So once the battery is built, it has this wonderful ability to undercut gas, because gas is always going to need $100 a megawatt hour. Now, what we have seen, and you know, these big pumped hydro projects sort of built under the illusion that you need a lot of long duration storage, and I increasingly think that is an illusion. And, you know, the Snowy 2 progress continues to be fairly slow, according to what I'm hearing. It'll get there, but by the time it gets there, there'll be a heck of a lot of batteries, 5, 6, 7 gigawatts operating in the NEM that were never envisaged at the time that Snowy was approved, or even when Barumba was approved in Queensland. And so, you know, those big projects may be needed for reserve, although you could do that job with gas as well. But they're not going to be needed in the daily market, and they're not going to make money in that market. Batteries are going to be doing all that, provided there's enough wind and solar to support them. Now, while we're talking on prices, and whilst I'm talking too much, I will note that in Queensland, which we have identified as the state that's going to have a lot of renewable energy come online in the next year or two, thanks to the wind farms that have been built up there, McIntyre and others, has also seen the Callide Sea coal generator returning to service. And that's already knocked the recent winter peak price in Queensland from $400 down to $250. That only lasts for an hour or two, but you know, it's a reduction already, and that's before all the new wind comes online, which will further cut into those.
Interesting stuff what you said there about batteries and what they need to actually, the sort of the marginal cost, because I did actually listen into the Neoen investor call overnight, the sort of thing I do overnight. And Xavier Barbaro, who's the CEO, was talking about the Collie battery and just sort of said that the contract that they've actually signed with the WA government will end up sort of, you know, covering a lot of the capex of that new battery. And I guess then that just leaves them free to plug into other markets, be it the arbitrage market, the FCAS market, and make big margins from there on. So that's a very interesting little stat that you've given.
It's not too different from the way that open cycle gas turbines have seen their role in the market. They have traditionally sold caps, that is, that the person who buys the cap won't have to pay more than $300 a megawatt hour. But at the price between what the generator pays for gas, its fuel cost, $100 and $300, then the gas generator operates for its own benefit. Now, the trouble with the battery is that you can't really write a traditional cap, because battery only has 4 or 8 hours duration, if you're lucky, but 4 hours, 2 hours, really. And so you can only write a cap over the evening peak. So not quite the same thing, but it's still interesting.
Yeah, interesting. Well, David, I think that's probably about enough for this week. It's been a good week. We do thank, I thank you for your wonderful insights as usual. I thank Victorian Energy Minister Lily D'Ambrosio. And I thank our sponsors, Evergen and Pylon. And thank everyone for listening out there. And we'll be back again next week with another edition of the Energy Insiders podcast.
Giles, will you be thanking our technology providers?
I think... I thank our producers for having incredible patience and skill to get around the problems raised by the technologies and parliamentary firewalls and God knows what else. But anyway, once again, thank you very much. And bye for now.
Energy Insiders was brought to you by Evergen, the market-leading renewable energy software business that optimises residential and commercial solar and battery systems. Evergen enables large numbers of systems to operate as a single fleet, so network operators can use them as a virtual power plant, generating significant value for consumers, network operators, and the energy system as a whole. Evergen software is powering the energy system of the future. Energy Insiders was also brought to you by Pylon. Pylon provides easy-to-use solar design software for installers and retailers with pay-as-you-go pricing, no monthly cost, and no locking contracts. Join Australia's top solar companies who trust Pylon to design high-resolution, CEC-ready solar proposals.